from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro in for Mina Kim. San Jose's Japantown turned 125 this year. We take a moment to appreciate one of San Jose's most beloved neighborhoods, full of vibrant restaurants and shops, a genuine hub for the region's Japanese-American community, and a place where the community's history is being safeguarded and repackaged for new generations. We have a fabulous group of people lined up this hour who will take us to the 19th century and back in this hour of Forum. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Rachel Miro in for Mina Kim. There are only three historic Japantowns left in the U.S., in Los Angeles, San Francisco, and San Jose. San Jose's Japantown turns 125 this year, so we're taking this hour to talk about this neighborhood, from its start as a hub for immigrant agricultural workers to its present day as a draw for historians, hipsters, foodies, and taiko drummers. Well, we've got a couple of historians in the studio with us now, Kurt Fukuda and Ralph Pierce, co-authors of a fairly new, fabulous coffee table book called San Jose Japantown, A Journey. Thank you both for joining us today.
Thank you, Rachel.
Thank you, Rachel.
Well, you know, why don't we start with the very beginnings of Japantown, San Jose, 125 or so years ago. Who was coming and why?
Okay, the majority were young men. Coming over to the United States to work for economic reasons, because in Japan, and especially in the southern area, there was a depressed economy. So many of them found work as farm laborers. And in addition to those, there were also students and a few adventurers and many sons who were not the firstborn, but the secondborn, and they wanted economic opportunities.
Now, with Chinese immigrants at around this period, they tended to sort of gather according to home region. Was that the case in Japantown as well?
Yes, yes. The Japanese tended to band together with others from the same prefecture, like Hiroshima, Shimane, Kumamoto, places like prefectures like that.
And Ralph Pierce, what can you tell us about the kinds of organizations, the kinds of buildings, retail outlets we would have seen at that time?
In the very early days, I believe that some of the very earliest businesses that we verified in Japantown, one was the Japanese Employment Agency, very important to the whole creation of Japantown, helping the workers. And the other was the Japanese Salvation Army.
Yeah.
Those were the two earliest businesses that we verified about 1900.
The Salvation Army. Love it. We've got a third guest joining us in the studios of KQED in San Jose, April G., artist and owner of Petite Galleria, an art boutique in Japantown today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So glad to have you here. Well, I'm wondering if we can talk next, on our whistle-stop tour through history about some of the laws that California started to pass to make it tough for Japanese immigrants, because almost as soon as they started arriving, these laws started raining down, limiting their movements, limiting who they could bring in or marry.
Right. And actually, the laws were aimed at the Chinese. The Chinese had actually come to California much earlier than the Japanese, and a lot of that is due to historic reasons. The Japanese weren't allowed to leave Japan until after the Tokugawas fell. But many of the laws, the anti-immigration laws, were actually aimed at the Chinese. And the Japanese really didn't feel the laws passed against them until they started buying land. And then it's like, oh, wait a minute. We don't want all these aliens buying
land. You can come here and pick the food,
right.
But we don't actually want you owning the farm.
Absolutely. So by 1913, you have the passage of the Alien Land Law, which said if you're a foreigner, you can't buy land, and you can't even they started seeing that, well, people still occupied land and some of them leased it, then it became like you can't even lease land.
It's kind of crazy. I have to ask, do you have relatives or previous generations who had this experience?
Yes. In fact, coincidentally, my grandfather, Genzaburo Inoue, was renting land, and his landlord, Mr. O'Brien, this was in the early 20s, decided to challenge the law to say, I do have the right to lease this land to a Japanese citizen. And the law was challenged all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. And unfortunately, it could not be overturned.
Wow. What year was that?
1925.
April G., do you have family history from this time?
No, actually, they didn't come till later. But I've learned about the Chinese Exclusion Acts and all. It was terrible times.
Well, let's move ahead to the Great Depression, because that definitely affected things. A lot of farmers struggled mightily to sort of stay on the land through one kind of arrangement or other. Ralph Pierce, you've talked in the past about sharecropping, which is, you know, a kind of workaround that many Japanese farmers engaged in to stay on the land, even though the law didn't really allow it.
Okay. So do you have a question?
Well, so I guess the question is, you know, that must have kept them struggling in poverty for a great number of years.
Well, I don't know. The Japanese were very creative, and not only the Japanese, but all of the farmers of that time. And somehow They struggled through.
One thing that did help was, we were talking about Japantown. A lot of people don't realize that right next door on 6th Street by Jackson and Taylor was San Jose Chinatown, also known as Heinlinville. There were some Chinese merchants, especially like the Tuck Wo grocery store, that were so generous, they extended credit to the Japanese mm-hmm. farmers. And this really helped the Japanese farmers through those struggling years. They actually were able to put off payment on goods.
So then moving right along, the Great Depression ends. A lot of farmers and local merchants are able to, you know, expand their holdings, buy new cars, start to relax a little bit. And then we hit World War II.
Yes. When that comes, and by the way, you know, I'm always amazed when Ralph and I were doing research on the during the Depression era, I was amazed that during the height of the Depression, you can have all these buildings like the Buddhist church. This gigantic church was built at the height of the Depression. How could they have managed that? It's one of the mysteries. But yes. Japantown was really at its height during its golden era when, of course, December 7th, 1941 hit, and then everything got turned upside down. You know, Ralph has some stories from people he's interviewed on hearing the news on the day of infamy.
Yeah, it's interesting when you read about when you research the history of San Jose Japantown and you realize this depression is going on. It's hard to realize that there is a depression. This really was the golden age of Japantown, the 20s and the 30s. And, you know, they worked hard and they played hard, just like everybody else. And December 7th, yeah, that was one photo we have was taken on the morning of December 7th. And I was speaking to one of the girls while she was in her 80s by the time that I spoke to her, but she was a young girl at the time that the photo was taken. And she said just moments after this photo was taken, Mr. Kogura, one of the local merchants, came running up the porch steps and announced that Pearl Harbor had just been bombed. And it's so poignant looking at that photo, realizing that in moments this family's whole life would be turned around and would never be the same again.
It's hard to imagine being in that moment when all of a sudden, even not just people who are Japanese immigrants, but Japanese Americans receive an order to vacate the premises, essentially, to vacate the Western coast, to sell off all of their goods at fire sale prices and leave home with nothing but a suitcase and the clothes on their backs.
Yes. And during that time, a few of the merchants held on to their stores, the ones who actually owned property, who were able to buy their buildings before the Alien Law Acts of 1913. What they did was they just closed up and secured their stores. A few of the other Japanese businesses that were closed down were taken over by Filipino merchants. But a lot of them just had to get rid of inventory. I talked to Mr. Norman Mineta, and he said during those last months, it was very hard to get goods because, you know, you're talking about a few months leading up to May, the end of May, when the Japanese actually, May of 1942, when the Japanese left, many of them couldn't go into grocery stores to buy because there was already anti-Japanese sentiment.
And fortunately, Japantown had an attorney named James Peckham, and he was very understanding and helpful, and he was really a big factor in terms of being able to help merchants sublease their stores and also helped get tenants for people who had homes so that the properties could be retained. So, you know, you have some sad stories, but there's a lot of very heartwarming stories too of people, neighbors, other farmers who would watch the farms of Japanese Americans, and also people in Japantown too. And that was another of many, you know, key elements to the survival of Japantown. Right. And also nice to hear about, to be able to dig up stories of support, you know, from the greater community for their Japanese American neighbors.
And I suppose it explains to some extent the historic character of the neighborhood today, because you still see many of those old buildings from the glory days.
Yes, yes. In fact, I was interviewing a family called the Tanizawas, and they had a grocery store before the war, and after the war, they decided not to come back. They relocated to L.A. But anyway, they came decades later to San Jose, Japantown in the mid-2000s, 2006, and they said, gee, it doesn't look much different than when we left.
Well, so let's fast forward a little bit. When people did come back, it wasn't all, you know, simply dusting off the padlock and going on in. A lot of people came back with really nothing. We're forced to sleep in old buildings like barracks almost.
Mm-hmm. Yes, the JACL, along with the Buddhist Church and the Wesley Methodist Church, the Konko Church, they put up hostels where people can go stay until they were settled.
And we'll just say that JACL is the Japanese American Citizens League. Yeah. Yes, and you mentioned the churches and the temples and these sort of formed community centers. They're still here today. It's where people go for weddings and funerals. It's,
right.
You know, draws people in from the entire region roundabout.
Yes, those churches are really the two anchors that really are yet another factor to the preservation of Japantown.
So now our whistle-stop tour continues to the 1950s. Did we see a neighborhood that had basically resurged, that had found its roots again?
Yes. By the 1950s, the population was double what it was before the war. And a lot of that is because a lot of people from other cities in California resettled in Santa Clara Valley, which was a little bit more amenable to Japanese. I don't mean there wasn't Japanese settlement here and there, but it was more accepting.
Do you think people in internment camps got word
from
folks, oh, California's better, you should come on over here?
Or
not only
San Jose
is better, because you'd get people from outlying cities that really felt that in some of these smaller towns had felt they weren't really welcome there. They knew they could find work in San Jose, and we had plenty of work. And like Kurt says, we had already had a Chinese and Japanese American base, mm-hmm. so we had already began to accept them, and welcome them as part of the workforce.
Right. And for example, there was a Dr. Kimura who was very popular after the war. He was from the L.A. area. And while he was interned at Heart Mountain, a lot of the people from San Jose met him and really liked him and encouraged him. After the war, come to San Jose. And so you have things like that. Or you have things like my father and his friends who grew up in Salinas, Japantown on Lake Street, that realized that, no, we can't go back to Salinas. There was not a very good feeling. So they heard, Santa Clara Valley and San Jose specifically was the place to go.
It's interesting you mention that because there were smaller Japan towns
yes.
all over California,
right.
and many of them did not survive World War II. And it seems this is in large part because folks coming back went to the places where they would feel welcome.
Right. I understand there were over 100. Japan towns before the war, and then they just diminished.
I don't know about 100, but a friend of mine has a T-shirt listing all the Japan towns.
I thought
that
it was over 100, yeah.
And it fills
I wonder if he's a large man, because that sounds like it would be a big T-shirt.
Well, I won't comment.
So then moving forward, we head to the 1970s, and I think for folks who are local to the region, they'll remember that things started to peter out. The energy level dropped
right.
in San Jose.
We had all sorts of – we had a gas shortage. We had some water shortage. We had the Vietnam War. We had Watergate. It was a challenging time, and it was challenging for Japantown too, because the Iseis were very elderly. They were starting to leave, and the Niseis had to step up. But then – you had the Sansei, and they grew up with this new generation. They don't trust the establishment. And are these young people going to carry on the culture? There was a lot of question about that.
Well, April G., do you want to chime in here? When did you set up your Galleria in Japantown, San Jose?
November 2013, so I'm the new batch.
You're a newcomer.
Yeah.
Who comes into the store? Do you have, mainly young hipsters? Are there little old ladies who are wandering in as well?
Yeah, there's actually a variety. You see just about everyone. There's, new mothers with, carrying babies on their backs and little dogs. And then there's senior citizens in the neighborhood, a lot of them, actually, and all, a huge Japanese population, and then also Filipinos and Hawaiians and, people that relate to that culture. Just it's become a melting pot, actually.
You mentioned the melting pot, and I'm wondering if you can speak a little bit to that. This is a place that is not just Japanese anymore. It's draws together Chinese, Koreans, whites, Latinos. Everybody seems to be making this neighborhood their own.
It's a great neighborhood to make your own. It's a sweet, wonderful neighborhood and there's still a strong Japanese culture there that I think just really ties everything together and just makes the neighborhood.
Explain a little bit about that. Name a specific business or two or three where you really feel the Japanese flavor.
Well, there's always something going on at the community center next to the Buddhist temple. Like at nighttime, you'll hear kids learning sword fighting and things like that. And, you'll see the Boy Scouts and the Girl Scouts, and you'll see there's Roy's Station, which is family owned, that's become like this cultural hub.
It's like a coffee
totally
house
alive.
Coffee
house. As soon as they formed there, I think it just sparked a new life in Japantown for entirely different feeling. Yeah.
If I might
yes, Kurt.
Interject, Roy Station is actually a gas station that was built in 1938. And the people who own it now, their grandfather actually was one of the early owners of the gas station after the war.
So it's a perfect example of a building that's been repurposed for something new. There's also that story with the Issei Memorial Building. Ralph Pierce, do you want to speak to that?
Well, yeah. And I might add real quickly on the theme of multicultural that historically Japantown has been multicultural. It began as Chinatown, and it was also an important center for the early Filipinos in the late 1920s. And then we have an African American church that got started.
1943.
Yeah, during the war. It's always been kind of very receptive to new immigrants and very open culturally. And your question about the Issei Memorial Building?
Yeah, tell us a little bit about the history of that.
That building was constructed, Kurt, was that about 1910?
1910.
As a hospital, Kuwabara Hospital. To provide services to Japanese immigrants who otherwise wouldn't have services or medical services or services in their language. And many of them, you know, couldn't go to mainstream hospitals outside. So it was operated under the auspices, under the control of, I think it was Dr. Beatty, but we had some different doctors in there. Early on, Dr. Asano, I believe, was one.
A lot of babies born there.
There were, and there was a midwife hospital. There were many midwives. There were maybe five or six midwives at any given time, with perhaps the most prominent being Mrs. Hori, who had a midwifery right across the street. Yeah.
I think it's hard for people who haven't been to really sense that this is all within walking distance. You can really step across the street.
Within two blocks.
Yeah, just a few blocks, yeah.
There's an Ethiopian church. There's all kinds of things.
The Ethiopian church used to be a theater, Japanese theater.
Yeah,
A movie theater
and live performances.
Yeah, and that within a short distance, that's the business district. But something else that people often don't understand is that Japantown has a large residential district as well that extends north quite some ways that has played and continues to play an important role in continuing the existence of Japantown.
It's sort of a feeder system of restaurant goers and shaved ice enjoyers, right. And beautiful, charming old Victorian homes.
And we have two important grocery stores too: the Santo Market and traditionally the Dobashi, which has been replaced by
Nichia.
Uh huh. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. April G. Anything else these guys are missing? They haven't even mentioned the San Jose Tofu Company yet.
Oh, well, they're missing out on great tofu.
or the stores where you can get mochi made
yeah,
fresh.
Manju.
Yeah.
So good.
I call them our national treasures.
Oh, yes.
Yeah, no, they are.
And now there's a ukulele culture.
There's a ukulele culture. Tell us about that.
Well, I think every Sunday for a while there was a huge group of ukulele players that would play at Roy's station, but there's like a culture for learning ukulele there, and just about everyone has a ukulele. So it's kind of funny. It's just another thread that's part of this tapestry in Japantown.
Well, we're talking about Japantown San Jose celebrating its 125th year today, or this year, I should say. Kurt Fukuda is with us in studio, and Ralph Pierce, the two gentlemen, are co-authors of San Jose Japantown, A Journey. April G. is artist and owner of the Petite Galleria in Japantown, San Jose. We'd love to hear your stories. Do you have family memories to share? Call us at 866-733-6786. Email us at forum@kqed.org. This is Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Rachel Miro. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Rachel Miro, and we're talking about Japantown San Jose, which is celebrating its 125th year in 2015. We'd love to get community memories brought to our phones and our email system. 866-733-6786. Now that you have the pen at the ready, 866-733-6786. You can email us at forum@kqed.org. You can also go to kqed.org/forum and add your comments online. We're talking with historians Kurt Fukuda and Ralph Pierce, who are co-authors of San Jose Japantown, A Journey. But we're also talking about Japantown today, a place that is full of vibrant shops and businesses and restaurants. Noel writes, we moved moved to Japantown in 2005 since it was close to transit and downtown. We grew to like living there and bought a house in 2010, two blocks over from where we were renting. Happy to see it becoming surprisingly hip, with the influence of artists a big part of it. Nice that you have April G on. I enjoy visiting her shop full of handmade goods.
Nice.
Well, April G, you've got a plug in there right away. Artist
great.
And owner of the Petite Galleria. For people who haven't been, what is it you sell?
I sell beautiful handmade gifts, so things that are artfully crafted by people from the Bay Area, mostly. I would say 90%.
And what would you say is the sort of tenor of those? Do they reflect Japanese culture, or is it really across the board?
They're across the board. They just reflect just kind of a beautiful aesthetic that I think Japanese people would appreciate and do.
And you yourself grew up in San Jose, correct?
Yes, I did.
A listener writes, your guest mentioned Japanese and Chinese immigrants not being able to buy or lease land in the early 1900s. However, they did not mention Indians of the Sikh religion who were also negatively affected. They had their legally owned land taken away from them, could not bring their wives to the U.S., etc. And yes, that reflects there was like a general sentiment that was very anti-Asian prior to World War II. And in a sense, it wasn't really a surprise that visceral racism existed beyond that.
Yes. In fact, in our book, we have a poster from Senator Phelan when he was campaigning, and one of his platforms was get rid of the Orientals.
Yeah, like let them work for us, but don't let them settle here.
Right.
It is a strange sort of dichotomy. On the one hand, you know, whether it was through farms or retail shops or restaurants, they were, you know, contributing to the economy and yet creating such a, well, I don't know if they were creating the visceral backlash, but there was one.
There was, yes.
I think you may see some of that still existing today with some of our neighbors from the South.
In what way?
In terms of we're happy to have them come and work here, but we don't want to accept them as full citizens kind of thing.
Oh, right.
So tell me how you see San Jose today. What is the sort of ethnic makeup of Japantown, this particular neighborhood now?
It is definitely Pan-Asian and getting mixed with all other cultures coming in because you know, it was mentioned that it is becoming a more hip area to come to, which I'm all for because a few times Ralph and I have, when we were working on the book, we'd have late night meetings and okay, let's go out for dinner and everything's closed, you know. So I'm glad to see it's changing, but I think it's definitely going to continue to be a mixture. I think it'll always retain a somewhat Japanese flavor because of the presence of the churches, the Japanese Museum, the JACL, and the UIKai.
You know, let me ask you, April G., I kind of wonder, and this might be a tough question, you know, some people would describe San Jose as being a sleepier Japantown compared to its neighbor to the north in San Francisco or its neighbor to the south in Los Angeles. Do you think San Jose's kind of sleepy?
I think it's a more authentic Japantown.
Authentic
definitely.
Yeah, I think it's got, you know, it doesn't have contrived buildings or, you know, everything is almost as it was in the past. And it's kind of got an organic culture that, you know, consists of people that have been there for many generations, maintaining their own homegrown festivals in a different way than San Francisco would put on a cherry blossom festival or something, you know, totally different organisms.
April
so,
is so
you know.
Right.
Yeah, well said.
Because as many times Ralph and I have talked about the fact that with San Jose, Japantown, you have a Japanese-American culture. It's never tried to be like a little a replica of Tokyo or something like
but
that.
But that seems in part, I mean, like, I don't know if that's a question of merit or just, you know, population movements, mm-hmm. because we do have or we have had modern influxes of Japanese immigrants or visitors who are here to work for a number of years who then go on to influence the Japantowns in San Francisco and Los Angeles. You could say it's just authentic in a different way.
Right. Yes.
Yes, definitely.
Ralph, you look like you're about to say something.
we're happy to be agreeable, but yeah, I mean it's you know that made it very interesting for us to study because it just is again a very organic, natural, and uninterrupted, and so it makes it a very very interesting study and
it
very
reflects
unique.
A distinctive aspect.
Yeah,
of
and again, it's Japanese American.
Oh,
yeah,
truly,
as opposed
yeah.
to Japanese, yeah.
And this is very interesting because as we were researching, there was some talk in the early 1980s of the city of San Jose thinking, well, maybe Japantown should be a tourist attraction. We have a couple of newspaper articles in the book talking about, well, maybe we should redevelop the neighborhood to be, you know, more Japanesey to get tourists to come there. So, but the neighborhood rose up against that, and you know there was the Nihon Machi Outreach Committee that you know was watching the city very carefully. And
well, I think that's been an ever-present thing in Japantown, which makes it so different from the rest of downtown San Jose. They have a very strong local community.
Yes,
yeah,
they're on the watch about everything. They want to keep everything nice and the flowers blooming and the streets clean and.
It is flowers are blooming and the streets mm-hmm. are clean. Let's add another guest to the mix. PJ Hirabayashi, co-founder of San Jose Taiko, has been living in San Jose, Japantown since 1974. Thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me. And hello to everybody over there.
Hi PJ.
Hello.
It's a tight-knit community. I noticed that everybody does seem to know each other. PJ, can you share with us something about San Jose Taiko? First of all, describe Taiko for those of us who may not be familiar or need a refresher course.
Okay, Taiko is the Japanese drum, and it has definitely become our signature in connecting with our cultural past, our cultural present, and our future as well. But it is that vibration that I think creates the change for us to wake up and also look at our Japantown, because we started at the Buddhist temple in 1973 and definitely have not strayed from that at all. So our connections are very close to Japantown in terms of helping with the preservation, its vitality, and also its revitalization.
Who comes to take classes to learn how to do it?
Well, we have different types of classes that we offer, from our junior taiko, from children from 8 to high school age, and then we also have our performing company, which is right now about 17 people strong, and we have apprentices and trainees that come from all over the country to train with San Jose Taiko. So, yeah, I would say, well, with our junior taiko population, we have maybe about 100. Oh, also an adult recreation class.
So you're never too old to learn taiko?
Never.
Let's
taiko
go
is awesome.
To the taiko. Have you done it, April G?
No, but I hear them, and they are hardcore. There are some rainy days where I've heard them play out there.
We now have on the phone Congressman Mike Honda of San Jose. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for having me.
Well, let me just ask, when was the last time you were in Japantown?
Well, I just got back from D.C. last night, so last time I was there was last just Sunday. Sunday,
so not too long ago.
I spend a lot of time in J-Town, so.
And yeah. And what do you like best about it in its modern iteration? Are you a fan of Roy's Station? Is there someplace else you consider your chosen hangout?
Well, there's a lot of hangouts. It's Roy's Station, it's Bimbo's, Jimbo's.
Jimbo's, yeah.
Jimbo's
for
place.
Ice cream.
Yeah, and then I like to hang out at the museum, and then there's that archery, where they have all these large
Object art gallery.
Yeah, and Paul Sakamoto's plants are over there. I go to Santa's Market for coffee sometimes. Shop at the store for, you know, Japanese food that's sold in quantities that, you know, for one person or two persons, you don't have to buy a whole bunch and stuff like that. So,
well, Congressman, you would be the perfect person to answer a question we have from Francis in Sonoma County, who wants to know what the story is with post-World War II reparations. Did those come through as promised? Have they been of the amount that was promised?
Well, it was an amount that was lobbied for. Yes, in 1976, the Japanese American Citizens League had started a national movement to get an apology from our government for incarcerating us in concentration camps, America style, and we wanted to get a full apology from them, and we did in 1988 under H.R. 442, and Ronald Reagan had signed that apology and the bill that was moved by Senator Inoue Akaka, and then spearheaded by then Congressman Normanetta and Bob Matsuri.
Is it your concern, Congressman, that, you know, as the older generations pass, people don't know what the history is or are not learning? Or do you think it's become part of the curriculum in schools and Californians at least have a sense of what really happened here?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that the curricula that's out there right now still can be enhanced, and it should be required by the State Board of Education and the Curriculum Commission. There's some materials in there. There's more materials out there that should be used for instruction in the high schools. And that's one of the reasons why the Japanese American Museum has been established in San Jose J-Town. There's one in L.A., but we have one here locally, and there are people who are present who can give walking tours of Japantown. It's history, both good and bad, and something that's very important for all Americans to understand is Japanese American experience is really an American experience in constitutional law and social justice.
Well, Congressman, thank you so much for joining us today. And just a reiteration of the call out to the Japanese American Museum of San Jose, which is a terrific repository with exhibits that give you a sense of what it was like to be in the internment camps, what it was like to be a Japanese American farmer in the 1920s and 30s. There's some great old farm equipment for people who find that fascinating. But thank you again, and goodbye, Congressman Mike Honda. All right, I think he's already moved on. Liz from San Jose, thank you for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
Hi. What do you want to share with us today?
So I'm actually a resident of Japantown. Me and my husband have lived there for about 10 years. We've chosen to buy a house and bring up our three young children. We love the diversity of Japantown. We love the close-knit community, the mixture of old and young. But my concern is I've seen a lot of changes over the last 10 years, especially over the last couple of years with gentrification and a lot of small businesses having to close or having difficulties. Both my older kids do their activities in Japantown. One of them dances at a halau there, halau na viola. It's been there for about 6 years. Both of them play the ukulele. There's a big ukulele.
Right, April G mentioned
there.
That. Yes,
and unfortunately, both of these community based programs are facing difficulties with rising rent and maybe having to move out of the area. And that just concerns me a lot because I believe that these bring a lot to the community. A lot of people who live in the community attend, and also it brings a lot of business into Japantown. And I'm just concerned how it's going to affect the character of the community. It's going to affect the character of the community just because it is such a popular area. Rent can go up, but it pushes these small, very vital and community-based businesses out.
Kurt Fukuda, I mean, can you speak to that? There are condo complexes going up, have already gone up in nearby streets.
There's the whole block of 6th Street that is undeveloped yet. And when that is developed, Japantown's going to change. But, Japantown has already gone through many changes. At the height of Japantown, you had 6 barbers. You had 3 drugstores. And you had like 4 grocery stores all within a few blocks. All of them are gone. The drugstores are all gone because they cannot compete with CVS and Walgreens. The barbers are no longer there.
They're not immune to the larger economic dynamics. Silicon Valley is the larger economic dynamic in this area.
Even through the 80s and 90s, you saw all these small businesses closing and then things changed. So, yeah, I know that is a concern. And as much as it pains me, change is inevitable.
April G., how are your rents doing?
Oh, very reasonable. I have a landlord that actually likes to keep things intact and make sure that the older people in the apartment are happy. And, he let the former tenant of Petite Galleria was Ted, who actually owned a typewriter shop for about 30 years. And he was never pushed up on rent.
Now, that's nostalgic, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's been a long time since most of us use typewriters. But that also reflects if you've got a landlord willing to hold off on asking for market price.
There are a few landlords who have a big heart, and you could see that these small businesses that you wonder how could they stay in business are probably have that.
Definitely. Well, thank you so much, Liz. Now to Rod in San Jose. Hi, Rod.
Hi. Good afternoon or good morning.
Good morning. What would you like to share this morning?
Well, I'm in the amateur Chidori band of San Jose, and we've been in existence for now 63 years, and I've been playing probably close to 40-something years in the band.
Wonderful.
We used to play in the old Okita Hall, which is now the Ethiopian Church, and I grew up in Cupertino. We had a ranch there. Went to the Buddhist church, and I watched, Japantown unfortunately shrink for a while. But now, thanks to especially Roy Station, I think they really revitalized the community.
Yeah, we keep hearing this again and again. Roy Station.
That family is definitely one of the great hearts of Japantown right now. The Rast family.
Can you explain for us, April, what it is about the kind of work they've done with Roy's Station that makes it such a center for everyone?
Well, for one thing, just deciding to pick this gas station, which takes so much money to renovate, just knowing that it's like a historical landmark and recognizing that it's worth the work, just that kind of mindset towards Japantown is what's kind of been the push towards making everything, wonderful. And the family itself, like they are very invested in the community, like each member of the family. From Carol is the one that like waters all the flowers in the neighborhood.
Carol is the heart of the family and the heart of Japantown.
Absolutely, right? And then her
Somebody's
daughters,
got I hope she's listening to
Jasmine
this.
Jasmine and Tamiko, they carry the torch in so many ways.
Yep,
Tamiko just made an art series dedicated to Japantown and the history of San Jose. So, they're really...
I've even seen husband Frank go up and down the sidewalk with a broom and just sweep.
Oh, absolutely.
Just to keep things clean.
And they kind of set an example for all of us, I think, that, this is how it should be and this is how it can be. Everyone can be, can pitch in a little bit and can care about keeping our culture alive and the streets clean and safe and everything. So
and Roy Station is right at the heart of Japantown, 5th and Jackson. In fact, one of the titles for our book, we were thinking of calling it 5th and Jackson because that is the center of Japantown.
Mike writes, San Jose Japantown is very much still a product of the people who reside in the area. It's not just a business zone. It's where Japanese American families have been living for generations. It has a culture unto itself. April writes, in the mid to late 1960s, I remembered the hot summer evenings practicing obon dances in the sweltering Buddhist auditorium. I hope they have air conditioning now. And during breaks, running to Tom and Mary's for candy, cold sodas, and shaved ice. Jess tweets, I do a free iPad class at the Akiyama Wellness Center. It warms my heart to be a small part of the community. Another listener writes, I'm half Japanese, and some of my best memories are of my sister, two brothers, and I dressing up in our kimonos for the Obon Festival every year. We've gone to it since the late 1960s. Still love it now with my own children. You know, one thing we have not mentioned, Ralph Pierce, is baseball.
Oh, thank you for reminding me. Today is March 27th. Today is the 80th anniversary of the Tokyo Giants' visit to San Jose, where they played the San Jose Asahi baseball team and San Jose beat them. And this was like interviewing the old-timers who played on that team in the early 1990s, interviewing them while they were still around. It was very clear. This was, you know, a 50 years of this baseball team, and they transformed from Asahi then during the war to Zebras. So they went from about 1913 to 1961. During this span, this was the game and the game that everybody remembered. And it was an amazing game. It was a ninth inning, you know, a win at the bottom of the ninth, you know, and everything was against San Jose, and their smallest player, the pitcher, the guy who had been holding the Giants to two runs, we were able to get the bases loaded, and Russell hit the winning run in, Russell Hinaga, the pitcher of the game and the smallest player. He got that hit and brought in Adrian Onitsuka to win.
Oh, my goodness.
And the fans,
speaking about this as if it was like, I don't know, one of the critical Babe Ruth games.
Fans poured onto the field, and it was just tremendous. It was just incredible.
Tell us a little, you know, for those of us who weren't there
including me.
Can't even imagine it, you know, who were these teams? What were these teams?
Well, the Tokyo Giants were formed as an all-star team towards the end of 1934.
In Japan
to face the visiting Babe Ruth All-Star team and to try to put up some kind of a representation. So these were all the best players Japan could come up with. And in one game, they actually lost by one point. Lou Gehrig got a home run. So this was a really formidable team. They came to the United States the next year, 1935, hoping to drum up support for the creation of a professional Japanese baseball league. So they were the first professional team, 1935, touring the United States, and only one other. They were supported largely by Lefty Odule up in San Francisco. And a schedule of games was organized. Only one other Japanese-American baseball team were able to beat the Tokyo Giants. That was the LA Nippons. This game took place in San Jose on March 27th, and it was a big deal. And San Jose did not expect to win. And it was an amazing thing. So,
you know, it's interesting you mentioned that a lot of these interviews you conducted a few decades ago now. And the folks who remember this time, that time, are passing
from
us.
Most of them are gone at this point, yes.
Alan writes, my mother, Yoneko Ishikawa Morishita, was born in the Hori, and I apologize if I am mispronouncing, Midwife Hospital in 1914 and is now over 100 years old.
Oh, Yone.
Maybe the oldest living person born in Japantown. She used to talk often about the dirt streets and horses on Jackson Street. She suffered a stroke 3 years ago and is now in a nursing home. And whenever we visit San Jose, she always points to the upstairs window above the yogurt shop, which used to be her father's Ishikawa dry goods store. it's hard to see how so many of her friends and relatives are passing on without being able to learn so much more about the history that's being lost. Her sister May and brothers Dr. Ishikawa and Moffat Ishikawa, who were both in the U.S. Army in World War II, all passed on. Just another of so many memories from seniors.
Yes, Dr. Ishikawa, her brother, was, I consider him one of the first historians of Japantown. He really collected a lot of information, and he led a lot of the earliest walking tours back in the 80s and 90s.
That's how I got started in all this, was I accidentally found myself in the middle of one of those walking tours. I lived outside Japantown and would walk down oftentimes for lunch to the Gombe restaurant. And I found myself in the middle of one of these tours, and it was just amazing. And his knowledge and his warmth just really came across. And I never imagined that I'd be, you know, one day contributing to preserving the history that he was sharing. But we interviewed him many times. He was a tremendous source of information.
Richard from Milpitas writes, "I love Japantown, especially the old Victorians that have been preserved. But on some streets, those were torn down and very cheap apartments were put up." He can think of one on Fifth Street right now, an old Victorian being moved, and hopes that the destruction and moving of old Victorians can be stopped. Any last thoughts super quickly?
Well, we're all for the preservation of Japan.
Yeah, I suppose I could have expected that answer. And I want to thank you both here, Kurt Fukuda and Ralph Pierce, co-authors of San Jose, Japantown, A Journey, a coffee table book that's well worth checking out, especially if you're down in San Jose's Japanese American Museum. April G., artist and owner of Petite Galleria, thank you so much for joining us. And our guests earlier, P.J. Hirabayashi of San Jose Taiko and Congressman Mike Honda. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell, Irene Noguchi, Tina Lauerberg, and Susan Britton. Our engineers today were Danny Bringer and Howard Gelman. We get online support from David Marks. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. I'm Rachel Miro, and this is Forum on KQED Public Radio.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.